Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. So that might be useful, helpful maybe to talk a little bit about use of the imagination and how Jung, Carl Jung, uses it for really things, the ways of really healing the unconscious and helping it to grow, to mature. How he looks at, I'll just talk generally for a while and then maybe I'll go into some technical things about him, but there's some. When he talks about the word archetype or the collective unconscious, I think these are some terms that many of you have heard in the collective unconscious, and the collective unconscious is full of archetypes. Let me just kind of define those terms to start with. The collective unconscious is like the blueprint of the psyche. So say for the animals, like dogs would have their own type of a psyche, and cats would have their own type of a psyche, and human beings would have their own type of psyche. And that psyche is the same for everybody, even though it's different. Like we can see that all of us are human beings because there's a human being blueprint. So like that in the psyche, there's a psyche blueprint that we all share. And I think so we have many, many things in common, even though our individual experiences are different. They're different, but they're all can be nicely categorized. Like for instance, there's experience like the major experiences in life, like the parent-child relationship, mother-father, mother-daughter, mother-son, father-daughter, father-son. These are all what we call archetypal. These are what we call archetypal relationships. So when you think of archetypes, you can kind of equate them in a sense to what are the natural instincts for the body, instinctual responses for the body. Like that, the archetypes are patterns. Instincts are kind of the patterns that govern the body and the needs of the body, things like that. So every physical body has certain instinctual patterns. And like that, every psyche has certain archetypal patterns. And those archetypal patterns are really true for all of the psyches, but of course the individual experiences that we have are going to be different. They'll be categorized in terms of these archetypal patterns. But they'll be different. Around the world, they'll be different. Jung did a lot of work, and Jungians have done a lot of work at kind of looking at the different myths that are around the world just to see this common thread of archetypal patterns. No matter what the culture was, And what the dress of them was, these patterns are to be found everywhere. And so what he will see is that the natural needs of the psyche, you know, are really, if you say, well, what are the basic natural needs or natural patterns of being a human being? Those patterns are always looking for a place in the world to express themselves. And so when the world starts to fail you in terms of being able to hold those patterns then are stuck inside the psyche trying to escape, trying to get out, trying to find a place to fulfill themselves. Like, for instance, say just the archetype, and we look at these usually as dyads between the two partners, you know, like the mother and the child, for instance, that's a dyad. Or in a marriage, you know, there's the two partners that are getting married, whatever they may be, those two partners, you know, form a dyad. Relationship between a student and teacher, a student and mentor is a dyad. Then there's other ceremonies that we expect to go through. Like when a child is given, in India, these are big ceremonies, when a child is given their name, nama. When we have an initiatory experience into a religion, like a baptism, or being taken in as a member of a church, or being taken in India, being given the sacred thread with the Upanayanam. These are very kind of big archetypal events that you'll find all over the world. Even going through puberty, you know, that in most cultures is a celebratory event. It's an initiation process that children are put through as they go through this period of puberty. Getting married, having children, you know, you're celebrating your birthday, you know. Doing rituals at the every year for the death of a parent. These are things that you find, I mean, we don't find them as much here, but we find them all over the world. Religious. There's also a religious archetype, which has a number of functions to try to give meaning to our life. You know, what happens to me when I die? Is there anybody in charge here? Is there a creator? Is there somebody that I can rely on? You know, as somebody who will be protect me and love me and care for me and look after me in some form or another. So, who is the one who's created this universe? These are all archetypal functions in the psyche. In fact, some scientists were questioning Jung one time about why does he even bring in religion? Why are you bringing in religion? This is psychology. He's, I'm not bringing in religion. You know, I'm not bringing in God. God is there. He's there in the hearts and the psyche. He's there in the dreams. You know, I'm not creating it. It's something, it's like there's a God blueprint. You can say it like that. There's a blueprint of God in the psyche. You know. And the individual wants to have a relationship with that God image. Whatever form it takes, there is a God image blueprint in the psyche that the human being is related to. And so if that's not honored in the sense of the normal idea of God would be somebody who's omniscient, and all-powerful and omnipotent and transcendent and immanent. You know, these are the big natural words. You know, omniscient, omnipotent, transcendent, and immanent. Everybody know what that means? Transcendent is free of this world, and immanent means pervasive to the world. Omnipotent means all the shaktimatvam, all shakti, sarvajnatvam. We have all of that too. We have the immanence, we have the transcendence, we have the immanence, the transcendence. We have the all-powerful, the shaktimatvam, sarvajnatvam, omniscient, all of those things. Because that is natural what the psyche wants for the God image. It has that, it says, that blueprint is there. And now say that the religion that you grew up in, especially if we go into the Middle Ages, contained you. This is the language that we use. Say the religion that you grew up in really contained you. So this is God. This is what the universe is. This is why I'm here. This is my dharma. This is what happens to me when I die, if I'm good. This is what happens to me when I die, if I'm bad. All of these type of things are there answered, really, in a religion. But you have to have Shraddha in that religion. So in the Middle Ages, in Europe, Christianity was by far, by an overwhelming degree, the religion that contained everyone. And there might be a little outliers here and there, but for the most part, it was just Europe was basically Christian. But what happened was, and everybody was held, there was a certain level of satisfaction there because God was taken care of. And who you are in the scheme of things was taken care of. But that religion could not withstand migration as we started to move into different cultures, you know, and see that there are different religions. That was a big thing as we started to move out of the European culture and like go to Asia and go to India and see these very, very different cultures that had nothing to do with Christianity and nothing to do with the Bible or anything like that. Nothing at all. And people were equally devoted. So that was a confusion because now there's more than one religion, you know. And that that initial, just for that alone, has been really shaken up Christianity. And this has happened over, you know, over the last 100 years or so, but really in a huge way over the last century or so, in a huge way, Christianity has been really shaken up by the recognition of other religions that believe in different things, that have quite a bit different, you know, and who have many followers. That's a problem. I think I told you it's a problem for your own Shraddha, that this is God, that this is God, and this is how we're supposed to relate to God, and this is what we're doing here. That is, was never questioned for a long time. It was not questioned. And so what about when things start happening that kind of make little cracks in the Shraddha? Another thing that happened was just science. Yeah, and Darwinism. Yeah. And that the earth goes around the sun and not vice versa. Because this earth is supposed to be the one earth that has the humans on it, and heaven is above and hell is below. That was just the model. Yeah. And human beings were at the center. So now we find out that the earth is going around the sun. That's not supposed to be like that. Because then the sun becomes the center. Other planets become the center. The sun is the center to just this planet, but others also. And then Darwin comes along and says that we've evolved from monkeys. And science is insistent about that. What does that do to our stature? We're supposed to be the ones, the humans, who are in the image of God, you know, and have a direct relationship with God and dominion over all other beings. And we ourselves have come from monkeys. You know? So these things started to crack the Shraddha and leave the psyche in disarray internally around the God image. And Jung came at a time when all of those cracks were starting to really take, he would call everything, it's like taking a pot and dropping it on the ground and everything's in shards. Yeah. And he felt that that is actually, during his time, and it's very far developed now, all of this, everything has kind of gone into shards and there is no real containing myth. Because containing myth means it has to contain you, right? If it doesn't contain you, it's certainly not a containing myth. And what he was seeing, I think, in his own life was that these religions, and he grew up as a Christian, a Protestant Christian, and he had many, many pastors in his lineage, you know. And so his father and his uncles, all of these people were Protestant pastors and very, very devoted, but also very tortured. Especially his father was very tortured because he was a Christian and he was a devoted Christian, and yet all of these events of the era were putting cracks in that kind of blind acceptance. What I mean by blind acceptance simply is that there was nothing really challenging it. You're born into it and it's gone on for generations. And so one of the huge problems that probably in our era is really that the psyches need, the human psychological need of the psyche on an archetypal level for a God image that actually contains and holds you is not really here. I found this so much in our school at CIS, because the school is really a school for seekers. It attracts people who really are trying to have a spirituality which contains them, you know. And so I meet all of these students, and they're all, well, first of all, the reason they're in the school in the first place is because they have some sort of seeking for something bigger than themselves, or they wouldn't be at a school like this one. So I get a whole array of these kind of students. And they're in, and coming to this school, they're in a place where everybody who's seeking, in whatever way they're seeking, comes to that school. So it's like a potpourri. You know what that means? It's like, oh, like if you make a stew and you put all kinds of carrots and all kinds of vegetables and everything in the stew, but it's still a stew. So a stew, but a stew has many different items in it. And so our students, all of their, each their own kind of item, you know. And so when I'm giving classes to these students, my classes are really more from the East, like looking at the Eastern containing myth and looking at Advaita Vedanta and Sankhya and Sankhya Yoga and the Bauda and all of these types of things. Some students, and in the past, even 20 years ago, students were really, really interested in this. But now a lot of new things have come that are very popular, like shamanism, like entheogens, you know, entheogens are different kinds of what they call medicines, but they're hallucinogens of one sort or another. So that's very popular in terms like in a religious way, in a spiritual way. And also what we call holistic sexuality. That's popular because it doesn't deny your embodiedness. And it doesn't deny your sexuality. In fact, it looks at sexuality as something that is very kind of spiritual and a way of deeply connected and being fully present. But for them, it's a spiritual pursuit. Now, I just want to say something about these different. They're all fine. They are what they are, but they are all of them are highly experiential. You know, sexuality is highly experiential, and it's also bliss oriented. You know, entheogens, highly experiential. I get to experience it right now. I don't have to wait. You know, shamanism also. Through drumming, we do different kinds of inner travels, you know, and meeting wisdom figures and all of this. Very, has a lot in common with Jung, actually, but people really take to shamanism because they're able to go into different realms of experience, not tomorrow, but right now, and have conversations with wisdom figures, you know, and get guidance from even power animals, you know. This is very common in indigenous cultures and in shamanic cultures. They can do it now, you know, and have an experience of being somehow with something greater than themselves immediately. Even there's a lot in our school, there's a lot of students going to Peru and to Mexico for ayahuasca. I have one of my students belongs to a religion, an ayahuasca religion, where what they do is once a month they all get together and they take ayahuasca, and they're very serious about it. They're not flaky people at all. It's not. I'm just pointing out is that they're, for humans, we need to have a relationship with something bigger than ourselves that we believe in. So if it's something like going deep in the psyche and traveling down into the psyche and meeting a wisdom figure that can hold you, that can guide you, that is very desirable, because there it is right now, you know. And it's the same if ayahuasca is a drug, it's considered we call it a medicine. It's considered something which is very spiritual. And it's called a plant medicine. And the plant itself is considered to be like a devata. And that plant will guide you. The plant itself, the ayahuasca plant, whatever you're using, that will guide you, you know. And so there's a tendency to, because of what I would say, the common religions that were holding people, where your parents go to church, they're still maybe going to church, and their belief systems there, that used to hold people and used to hold their children and their families, it's not doing that anymore. In one sense, it's not doing that. And so the mind just kind of moves on. Because the mind, the psyche is still spiritual. It still needs to find something that makes sense out of this life and contains me. And contains me in a meaningful way. Kind of like Ishvara contains the jiva in a meaningful way. And it can be understood. The problem is with a lot of the Western religions that are just available to the public. I'm not talking about maybe there's in every religion there a mystical aspect to those religions, but they're not just popularly available, and how far they go, I don't know. I'm not even commenting on that. I'm just saying that we as human beings need to know. We want to know who I am, why I am here. Why did God send me here? Is there a God? What am I supposed to do here? You know? What is my mission? What is my purpose? What happens to me when I die? What is this all about? Those are natural longings in the part of the psyche. And now we are born in a time where the world is very small. There are many, 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 many religions, all available to us and all available to everyone. There are many different kinds of New Age religions also, you know, that are much more experientially oriented. The world is full of them. And people don't know what to do. My students at CIS, they don't know what to do because there's so many. So they feel kind of lost. And then they can get kind of, this is not a lot of, but I've noticed it in maybe three or four students in the last couple of years, which is, in a way, it's a lot. They get angry in this kind of a anger, which goes like this, kind of, I'm not going to believe what anybody says. You know, I'm making my own way, you know. So don't try to tell me anything, you know. And so there's that. In fact, when I'm at school and when I'm teaching, a lot of times means three or four, which seems like a really lot of times. But what'll happen is maybe I'll be teaching the class in Eastern Theories. Okay, so these classes, like say, for instance, if I'm talking about Buddhism, and I'm kind of going back, when I teach these classes, I go back to the classics, like what was actually being said. What was Buddhism at the time of the Buddha? What was it? What did they understand? What is Vedanta? Not Neo-Vedanta, but what is classical Vedanta? What is it that they know? What is it they understand? Yeah. And what is yoga? What is it trying to accomplish? What is it? What do they know? Because when you go back to the roots like this, you would think that you would be able to see something that has stood the test of time for literally thousands of years and has, so therefore, has something important to offer. And so there's still a lot of students that can go there and try to see what these things are and what it has to offer and how it is helpful and what they even mean by liberation, even that there is something like liberation. So there's some students that just wake up, kind of like us, you know, at least like me for Vedanta, just, oh, such a huge relief, because I was contained by it, and my mind could ask any amount of inquiring questions, and I just became more contained. So it could handle my mind, and it could handle this era. So I was very contained by it, you know, and it matched reality for me. So remember, for knowledge, it has to match reality also. It has to match your experience. You have to have a means of knowledge for it, you know. And it has to be logical. And in the past, our religions didn't really match our experience because salvation is somewhere else, you know. And you can't prove any of it. It's all faith-based. And so that became something that, because of so many reasons, like the globe becoming very small, and Galileo, and you know, and then Darwin, and all of these things happened that really cracked all of these things. So those all went to shards, and now everybody is looking for that containment somehow. So they're searching outside of their own culture, because for most, the culture and the religions, the older religions like Christianity, and even a lot of people are very proud of being Jewish, but they've more or less, a lot of them, they're proud of being Jewish, they're proud of their religion, but they don't participate in it. You know, they hold it in disdain, with respect, you know, but they don't do anything about it. And Christians don't even hold it with respect. Many. They just walked away from it. Many, many, many. But, so, anyway, so much for that, for now. So this, there's an inner angst that is in everybody's psyche, because what was strongly held us at one time as a world, as a community, does not anymore, you know. There may be a few here and there, and in fact, Jung will say, if anybody's still contained in their religion, let them be, leave them alone. You know, don't try to destroy that, because their psyche gets the pleasure, the deep pleasure of being contained in their belief system, you know. So leave them alone. That's what he says. I totally understand that too. As a therapist, I totally understand that, and I respect that also. You know. They don't need any help. Religious, spiritually, they don't need any help because they feel contained. You know? And so you don't want to take like a sledgehammer to the pot and ground, you know, turn it into shards. You know? But many, many people in our era are not contained at all. Yeah. And so when a person is not spiritually not contained, and yet there's this dyad, archetypal dyad inside between you and the divine, you know, that dyad is kind of very, on a very deep level, we would say, down at the very nature of what Jung will call the self, that the self, for him, the self is not Atma. The self is the organizing principle of the whole psyche. And so the God image is at the depth of the psyche as that organizing principle. And it is very important for a person to have a relationship with that deep that deep central organizing principle, which he calls the God image. And without a relationship with that, a person feels lost. And because that relationship is broken, what happens is that God image gets projected out, because you don't have contact with it anymore because the Shraddha is gone. And yet that God image is still there. And so it projects out onto, Jung will say, all of the isms, like capitalism or communism or being or having extraordinary wealth. These are the things which are meaningful. These are what one Protestant theologian will called Paul Tillich. I don't know if you know of him. He calls that quest for God. He'll say, what is your ultimate concern? That is God for you. What is your ultimate concern? What is the most important? And that is your God image. Well, what if the most important has nothing to do with what we would think would be the God image, but has to do with one of the many isms, you know, in the creation? You know? And then that becomes what is containing you. So God becomes secularized. That's also happening in many ways. So I find that sometimes now in a way that I didn't used to find. I find that in my students at CIS. I find the other two, people who are really seeking, wanting to know something in a way that we're used to them wanting to know. But others who have kind of gotten rid of that, the God out of the God image, are projecting that onto something else. And one of the things they project it onto is themselves. So what happens is there comes a strange type of spiritual narcissism. And that kind of looks like this. It's, I know what I believe, and I'm making my own way. It's like saying, I know what I believe, and I have my own religion. I have my own spirituality, and that's what I follow. And so I will take, and some of it's quite sophisticated in terms of their ability to talk about it. I'll say, I will study all of these other religions and study people and study lots of different things and take from it, you know, what rings true to me. And so it's never about what the value of what they are saying. In other words, say if you're studying Buddhism or Vedanta, just in that type of environment. It's not at all about what the Vedanta is actually saying or what the Buddha is actually saying. It's about how does that resonate with what I believe. And it's only the things that resonate with what I believe that have any value. And so I become the center. I become the center. I become the spiritual center. And I follow my own way. So there's quite a bit of that. And that creates, I think, a kind of a false confidence in the psyche, because no one really knows what's really going on, you know. So that is gonna be falling flat all of the time, or even if you project it onto a communism or capitalism or, you know. Being a European or being an American and all of these kind of stuff, being white, we have such a huge thing going on. Being white, white supremacy, all of these type of things, these are isms that make people feel on a secular level that they belong somewhere, that something is holding them and containing them. And so for Jung, so just to draw this in a little bit, for Jung, all of these kind of archetypes, this being one of the biggest, one of the most major archetypes, you know, they have to be recognized, and then we have to come into relationship with them. But we have to come into relationship with that internal archetype, which, I'll talk more about this later, but anyway, which can express itself in innumerable ways. This God image can express itself in innumerable ways, but it is still the God image. It's very much like in the Vedanta, in the Bhagavad Gita, where when Krishna says, whatever way you come to me, in whatever way you want me, whatever way you worship me, in that way I will come to you. Yeah. And so it's getting in touch with that inner God image, and coming into relationship with it in a conscious way, so that you find in your own psyche that there is something in the depth of the psyche that is very related to the ego, which for Jung is only the conscious mind, just the conscious mind, needs to come into relationship with the organizing principle of the entire psyche. And so as though bow down with the buddhi, though, to that organizing principle of the whole psyche. So it's almost like in this world, if you imagine this world, if we see Ishvara as the organizing principle of the entire creation, you know, I'm just using organizing principle for Jungian sense. But we have to come into, for us, we have to come into relationship with that. We have to come into relationship with Ishvara. We have to recognize our place in the scheme of things. And then it goes further for us as Vedantins to recognize that actually myself is the center, is the very center of this entire organizing principle. So in that way, then I'm the center of Ishvara, and I'm also the center of all beings that are within Ishvara. So that makes sense. I come into that direct, immediate relationship, which is deeply internal. Pratyagatma, it's the most internal that there is yourself. And then that I recognize as the self of all of the parts of this organizing principle and of the organizing principle itself. So this is just a pattern that when I wrote a couple of things on Jung and Advaita Vedanta, because I saw that Jung became so close to understanding the relationship of the jiva to Ishvara, but only within the psyche in the relationship of this conscious ego to that the deep organizing principle. He also said the deep organizing principle of the entire psyche. He also said that we don't know in terms of the unconscious, when you go into the psyche, we don't know in terms of the unconscious where the unconscious ends and the transpersonal begins. Yeah. So, because it's unconscious, so how can you possibly know? Another thing he said that is interesting, and we also cannot know that this external world, you know, is also not the psyche. Because what's the difference? You know, if I'm seeing something externally, all of it is known to me. If I'm seeing something internally, also all of it is known to me. So who am I to really say that only the internal is the psyche and the external is something else? When in fact, the only information you have, one way or the other, is the vritti. See, if I'm looking out, how do I know what's out there? The vritti. If I'm looking inward, how do I know what's in there? The vritti. Your knowledge is the vritti. That's all. So how am I to say that this is more real than what is going on internally? You can say it's different, but how can you say it's more real? Based on what? Based on the vritti? Vritti is a vritti. So that becomes, you know, there's a lot in Jung that becomes really powerful. So now kind of understanding that as he looks inside, he journeys inside. He will go have relationships with emotions, with feelings, with the inner world of the psyche, and he finds that all of those images, those feelings, all of that, are all connected. Like every image has a feeling. The feelings and images are connected. And so if you're traveling inside, the shamans do this also, but we're just talking about Jung now. When you're going inside into that inner world, you're going into that inner space, which Jung views as very real. And in fact, we do too. It's not like we're going into that inner world of the psyche and dismissing it as not real. In fact, if you go back, if you even go to into India, into their pujas and into their relationship with their Ishta Devata, they don't just think of that as, oh, that's only my fantasy or that's only my imagination. They don't think of it like that at all. They're coming into relationship with their Ishtadevata. They can go on a walk. We can all go on a walk. We can do puja to our Ishtadevata. We can do puja to Ishwara. We can go on a walk with our Ishtadevata. We can ask. And Ishtadevata, let me just say this. Ishtadevata does not have to be a Hindu Ishtadevata. It could be a tree. It could be an animal. It could be Jesus. It could be what in whatever religion is there. It depends on who is your Ishtadevata. You know, mine might be someone and yours would be somebody else. It's like, it could be an animal. It could be a tree. It could be a huge oak tree. It could be a fig tree. You know, it could be any kind of wisdom figure. Because in whatever form you worship me, in that form I will come to you. And so who's to say? Who's to say in what form, if you're evoking an Ishtadevata, in what form that manifests for you? And if it does manifest, if there is an Ishtadevata that when you are with that form, or you let that form embody you, you know, to just take over this body in a way, you know, so that this Ishtadevata is just pervading you, and you love that. It's your Ishtadevata, you know. And when you allow that to happen, or you allow yourself to come into relationship with that, you're coming into relationship with Ishwara in a form that you can relate to. You can relate to Ishwara as a whole also. But when you take Ishwara in a form, then it's more easy to have conversation. It's more easy to take a walk, you know. And it's imaginal. You're going into the imaginal realms of the psyche. Not that imaginal is not real. They don't look at it like that at all. Jung doesn't look at it. Hindus don't look like that. If they're doing a puja to Ishwara or to Ganesha, or if we're in Coimbatore and we're doing a puja to Dakshinamurti or to Jnaneshwari, and you're a Hindu, then those murtis have all the rituals that are required to invoke the actual presence, the actual being of the devata. They're not just stone. There's many, many different rituals and things that have been done. And when you do those pujas, say you, like in Coimbatore, maybe the puja takes an hour and a half to 2 hours to do. And when it's done, the whole presence of Bhagawan is there. It's very potent. It's like a huge blessing is there, and that's supposed to happen. Because you've done the puja, and you've evoked Bhagawan, and all of those rituals have been done to evoke that presence, so that presence is there. You know? So, being able to have the freedom to, like if we say, you know, evoke the presence of Ishwara, come into relationship with Ishwara. That's a relationship. It's not a pretend relationship. You're actually evoking Bhagawan's presence, you know. You're evoking your devotion and your prayers and whatever conversation you want to have. You're actually doing that. You're not pretending to do it. You are doing it. If you invoke your Ishtadevata and you sit there or take a walk or have a conversation, that is exactly what you're doing. Yeah. And in times, in ancient times, like even in the West, with the Iliad and the Odyssey, and they would always take a walk with their devatas, the Greek gods and goddesses. They would walk with them, they would talk with them. And what's the difference? Why can't we take a walk with our Ishtadevata or have a conversation or say, this is what's going on and I need help with this? Or come and just be with me and help me see how to take care of this problem. That's a wonderful thing to do. If I have a problem, I almost always do that. If I don't invoke Swamiji, I'll invoke Bhagawan or I'll invoke the Ishtadevata and just say, okay, how would you handle this? And I let them handle it. I do it all imaginally. Let them handle it. And they will, and it'll be, oh, that's good. That's how it's supposed to be, actually. Because when you invoke your Ishtadevata, remember, can be in any form, you're invoking Ishvara, and you are invoking your highest self. Because the Ishta Devata doesn't have all this Jiva Srishti, you know, all of these complexes, all of these hurts, all of these wounds, you know, all of the problems that we have. The Ishta Devata doesn't have that. Ishta Devata, this is Ishvara, and I'm just part and parcel of Ishvara. See, simple. If you see the deities in the temples, they're just sitting there, being with themselves. That's what they're doing. So when Swamiji says, you know, gently close the eyelids, this gentle smile. When they make these murtis, they are so meticulously defined how wide the lips are, how much of a smile is there, how far apart are the eyes, where does the nose, all of this. You know, so that now when they do it perfectly, when you look at that murti, you know, you just see them with themselves, which is exactly what you're supposed to see. They're with themselves. And so when we invoke that facial expression, that murti, we become that murti, and that invokes, you know, our own presence. You know, it's just because in psychology, sometimes we say to our client, and just to walk around smiling, just smile. Because they're depressed and smile. Just pretend. Just walk around and pretend like you're happy. You know? Because the murti is taking on the form of a happy person. And this murti means the form, is very connected to the sukshma sharira. They're connected to each other, right? And so if you take on the form, the chemistry changes. The chemistry in the body changes. So all of these things, you know, these are maybe not so well defined and taken very much for granted in Hinduism, but in India and the Vedanta, but it is all there, you know. Sometimes we do pujas and do rituals without, and they're so wonderful and so beautiful, but we may or may not understand the incredible power that is there in that ritual or in that puja or in invoking that love or in invoking that devata or that deity. It's actually an incredible thing that is happening when we do that. And we can actually do it all of the time. It can be just a very rich part of your life. Why not take a walk with Ganesha? I mean, it's wonderful to take a walk with him. He's a very, very wonderful guy. You know? Why shouldn't we take a walk? Why shouldn't we have deep conversations with your Ishta Devata or with your power animal? I don't know if that's probably a better word. Well, let me put, instead of power animal, you know, all of the, because that's a very shamanic word. But do you know that all of the devatas, they all have their own animal as their vehicle? All of them. That is amazing. That animal looks after them, takes them places, does things with them. So you can have your own animal. Take a walk with your animal. These are big, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful things that we have to bring back into our life. These used to be very common, but very commonplace. People didn't think about it. It's just how it is. But we've kind of lost these things that Jung will call the reality of the psyche. We shouldn't let those things be lost. So what I'm saying, because I have to go do this thing now, what I'm saying is that we should experiment. Experiment really a lot with your imagination and with your Ishta Devata or Ishta Devatas. Don't be afraid to take walks. Don't be afraid to go on imaginal journeys, to ask all kinds of things, to tell all your problems, and to invoke your Ishta Devata to see if you have any trouble with someone and you can't handle it very well. How would they handle it? Just let them become you and then imagine that person and see how they handle it. It's really wonderful. Because they will handle it and you'll say, yeah, that's right. That's how it should be handled. Because they don't have the psychological problems that we're suffering from. You know? And so these type of experiments with our inner world are to me, they're invaluable. They just increase the size and the scope of your psyche tremendously, because you're not afraid, oh, that's just my imagination, or I'm just making that up. Pfft. Don't even go there. It just takes you out of it. So that kind of sets itself for a different kind, doing more imaginal work in our meditations. All right, I have to go. I'll see you later. Okay.